You're listening to a Stranger podcast, www.thestranger.com.
Hi, you're listening to Invisible, the Stranger's weekly conversation with people in art. I'm Jen Graves. I'm here at the Seattle Art Museum Suite at the Alexis Hotel with Maxwell Anderson. Hi.
Hi, Jen.
You're in town for a very, very short time.
Yeah, I think right? 18 hours or less. I'm not sure how long.
Okay. Well, we won't try to take too much of it, but to kind of cite your resume would take up about half of this podcast time, so I won't do it. I'll just say that since 2006, you've been director of the Indianapolis Museum of Art, and you have a long history working in antiquities research and curatorial departments involving Roman and Greek art. And, of course, you did have that one stint running the Whitney. But the first thing I want to ask you is that there is a presidential primary coming up in Indiana.
Very exciting.
Who are you supporting?
The state is bubbling. Well, I can't say who I'm supporting, but I can say that it's very exciting.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, in a less stressful election question, can I ask which of the T-shirt slogans on your blog you're voting for?
You know, again, I'm being agnostic. I want the public to decide. Obviously, that's what...
Do you think that they would follow you?
No, that's what the blogosphere is all about. It's individual choice.
I see. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Noncommittal. The whole gamut.
Well, you know, a lot of people have wanted us to have fundraising events for either Obama or Clinton.
Mm.
Not so much for McCain. And we can't. Mm-hmm. Do political events or religious events or mm-hmm. fundraising events. So mm-hmm. I have a lot of frustrated staff.
I really, bet.
Yeah, it would be so exciting to see that happening in our soil.
But. I bet. Can you generally not commit on political matters?
No.
It's sort of like a journalist.
Yeah, and it also mm-hmm. basically sets up a paradigm in which you make the museum political all of a sudden.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no advantage to that, really.
Mm-hmm. So speaking of art coming in contact with world matters.
Mm-hmm.
You were talking tonight at the Seattle Art Museum about antiquities and about museums dealing with the problems involving antiquities.
Yeah.
What are some of the things that you think are still going wrong? I mean, there's been a lot of self-correction in and a lot of just sort of self-flagellation in the museum industry mm-hmm. in the last couple of years about this. But what's still out there that kind of needs to be addressed?
I think the key thing is that we could continue to debate which countries have which laws and regulations that affect their export of works of art. Or we could find a bright line where we agree that, in effect, from this date forward, acquisitions have to meet a certain standard of evidence. And that is, I think, what we're coming to in the Association of Art Museum Directors, is to understand that that's necessary. And that in a way it's curative, because it gives us the freedom then to go out and argue on behalf of an open market mm-hmm. for antiquities, for your exchange of objects, more opportunities for collaboration, and less, in effect, problems that we can create for ourselves by acquiring works without sufficient ownership history.
Mm-hmm. I understand you can make those sorts of decisions, and am I correct in understanding that the IMA sort of drew that bright line in 1970? That's a kind of a banner date having to do with the law. You know, it provides a certain amount of direction, but how difficult is it to draw a line, you know, to say that's going to be the date? I mean, of course, the law is helpful and applies, but before that, it's still a murky area.
Yeah, well, the laws are contradictory. I mean, even in the U.S.,
mm-hmm.
the Justice Department has one way of enforcing the law, which is through subtle cases that are argued on behalf of a foreign country in a state Supreme Court. And then the State Department has another approach, mm-hmm. which is through the UNESCO Convention.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't work together. They work actually against each other.
Our government?
Our enlightened government and all of its laws. And
who do you think would best fix that?
Yeah, I'm not sure that is actually fixable in the short term, regardless of how enlightened
right.
the candidate is. But the connection between how museums might choose to have a bright line and the way in which it would affect going forward acquisitions of, say, works in the private collections, which mm-hmm. is the biggest single issue we face, is that although there will be a line that will say, and most likely it will be 1970 for the whole association, there will have to be carve-outs, there will have to be exceptions in which there won't be sufficient documented evidence to say something without question left a country before 1970, but there's a burden of evidence that was suggested. And we also want to make sure that museums have the room to make acquisitions in which they need to defend them and say very transparently, here's what we know about its history and here's what we don't.
Mm-hmm.
But I think simply to allow nature to take its course and every museum to follow its own whims isn't productive, because it ends up putting all of us in a sense of risk where we're the lowest common denominator is the one everybody thinks about.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Is there a way in which, you know, these decisions... I was going to ask you about the relationship between museums and collectors, and kind of apropos of the recent situation in Los Angeles, where Eli Broad, you know, was maybe going to give work to LACMA, and then no, he's not going to give work to LACMA, mm-hmm. but, you know, so, and then kind of the, I mean, it's a question about changing models of the relationship between the museum and collectors. I mean, as museums, I've, you know, in the past you've advocated for the importance of the permanent collection in any museum. And part of the response to the Broad decision on the part of some people has been, well, you know, good, then the museum doesn't have to take care of more work, which, you know, has a sort of counterintuitive ring to it, based on the idea that collecting and is a very foundational part of what museums do. That said, you know, that kind of sort of major collecting puts you in a certain sort of relationship with very powerful collectors. So I'm wondering, what is that decision and LACMA's response to it and the art world's response to it signal about the changing relationship? Or is the relationship changing between museums and collectors?
I think the relationships have always been individual. And go back to the late 19th century with the founding of the Boston Museum and the Metropolitan Museum, in which you were reliant on individual philanthropists to do as they saw fit. And back to the creation of the Frick Collection or the Carnegie Museum or any of these institutions that really depended on a single powerful individual with an abiding sense of what was right and how they wanted to collect and how that would inflect itself in a public institution. There's nothing particularly new about this. I think it's more that there's a lot of attention paid to the niceties and nuances of how objects make their way into the public domain, whereas in the past it was a bit less clear because... people didn't talk about these in polite society. It was just they were available for display. What's the problem? And even when you look at the labels of institutions at the beginning of the 20th century and before, it isn't always obvious how an object came into the possession of an institution. Sometimes it was gift or bequest or purchase. And sometimes it took a long time. So I don't think there's anything particularly new about what's gone on at LACMA, except that there was a false start around assumptions about what it would be and that it changed. But that's really not, in fact, different from the ways in which private collectors would at intervals give works and hold out on others until later on or until after their death. So I think in the end it's more a question of how an individual can support an institution. And what concerns me more than anything is the gray line between private collectors and museums in the sense of joint ownership, and that's where I get a little concerned, where we give a tax deduction to an individual to turn an object over, and now there seems to be a kind of appetite for rethinking that by dint of the private museum phenomenon. And we have to be careful about tax law. I mean, there's a code, and people have to follow it, and I think there's a great deal of creativity that's been spawned by venture philanthropists joining museum boards who may have a perception that it's at variance with what's normative and what's appropriate. So there's a bit of a Wild West phenomenon, I think, in how museums are collecting today.
What is the role, two questions, does the role of a particularly heated market enter into this conversation? And two, I'm thinking about kind of the way that you would consider something like, you know, you're talking about an earlier era when you wouldn't necessarily know visiting the museum where the works came from. You know, it just brings to mind last year, the Metropolitan show, the Dutch painting show, where the names of the donors were over the paintings. It was pretty striking.
Well, no more striking than the paintings themselves, or Dutch pictures where the patrons are in the painting, or in late medieval and Gothic pictures where the patrons are holding the cathedral, handing it to a figure in the Old Testament. I mean, there's nothing particularly new about that.
Except, don't we think of our institutions as not commissioned by the donor? You know, where you do think of an artist as commissioned by the person who, you know. Is there, so for you, that doesn't feel particularly of interest?
Well, I think that depends on what an exhibition's out to achieve. If it's mm-hmm. burnishing the reputation of an institution as one that's benefited from great patronage, mm-hmm. I think that's a defensible thing to do. Mm-hmm. And I guess it's more a question of the balance of programming and how much of it is leaning over backwards in that direction versus pursuing scholarly themes or schemes, themes which may not have been researched to death before, or all the things we want exhibitions to be, which mm-hmm. is revelatory. Mm-hmm. And I think for some people that probably was very revelatory about the extent to which the individual tastes of collectors are actually what museums are built on in this country. It is not the kind of connoisseurship and the chase and the capture that Tom Hoving has written about. That's additive to the core, and the core is private collections entering museums. 80 or 90% of what we acquire mm-hmm. is collections of collections.
Mm-hmm. How about the market? Does it have a role to play?
It has an enormous role to play, and it's this sort of febrile moment where people are paying attention to it as if they're watching Bloomberg and the stock mm-hmm. returns, mm-hmm. and monitoring creativity as if it has that kind of pulse, which is a phenomenon like the tulip craze or the Florida land grab right before the Depression. And it surely will have a correction, and it will surely sort out people who are speculating in ways that are purely about the hope for quick gains. And I think that is similar to crazes in the past, again, like the tulip craze. Mm-hmm. And, unfortunately, it's also led a lot of younger artists to think that unless their work is validated by the market in certain ways, they're not achieving something. And I think that's the unhealthiest part of it all. It's a disincentive to mm-hmm. artists to make work without the constant drumbeat of the market.
Mm. Is there a way in which it helps museums, this kind of
No.
fervor?
No.
No?
Not at all. We're priced out of
auctions. Well, absolutely,
we're priced out of the art fairs. We're priced out of galleries. We are bystanders in watching this. And then we become, in effect, beholden to the vicissitudes of how an individual artist's mm-hmm. career is perceived. Mm-hmm. The galleries are, in effect, coerced into withholding works that might have a higher street value for the collectors that they
rather
hope
than,
will acquire them. And so it's a very artificial situation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. On the IMA's website, which is possibly the most extensive museum website in the country, it's a pretty amazing thing. There's an entire section listing recent deaccessions. There's an entire section, I presume, is updated, listing acquisitions. Even with deaccessions, there are photographs and there are dollar amounts. And is that something you instituted? What's mm-hmm. why the transparency on, especially deaccessions, which are delicate?
Well, they're only delicate if you acknowledge. If you don't acknowledge that we're public institutions that have an obligation, and we, like all art museums, we have an attorney general sitting astride us in some way who's monitoring our performance in relation to the charter that we started with, and creating the mysticism around collecting, and once it enters the public domain, is, I think, a problem. I think it's very important for us to be as direct as we can. I also think the web is a remarkable resource in allowing for transparency, and we built a dashboard last year which is intended to look not just at dollar values of things, but at what's important to measure, mm-hmm. such as the number of new works on display in the permanent collection month to date, mm-hmm. or the number of works out on loan to other institutions, which I consider a measurement of how our collection is valued mm-hmm. by peers. Mm-hmm. And those are things that interest me a lot more than attendance, because attendance mm-hmm. is a completely relative data set in relation to what part of the world you're in and how many attractions there are apart from you and so on and so forth. So we try to give a pretty full measure of what an institution should be looking at. And we're always going to be adapting it. It's not a static thing. Mm-hmm. So I look at the website as a great gift to pry open what has traditionally been a very furtive operation, mm-hmm. the art museum. And most of what happens in a museum is behind the scenes anyway. It's in research and conservation and security and climate control and all these things nobody is conscious of when they just have that hagiographic moment in front of a work of art, which is so occasionally so transformative. But it's important to reveal all the other things that go before that.
Mm-hmm. Maybe this is a question that it is presumes a kind of a bad faith from the beginning, but considering that there have been controversial deaccessions, you know, in the last few years especially, but through time, I suppose. Are there any works, you know, the deaccessions list that's on the website is works, I presume, are objects that have already been deaccessioned. Mm-hmm. Are there any works that you would consider it important to publicly announce the plan to deaccession prior to the deaccession rather than afterward?
I could see it. I think what we look at is...
Or is that essentially an object you shouldn't be selling in the first place?
Yeah, I mean, we go through a multi-step process the way all museums do of evaluation by the relevant curator, and we mm-hmm. figure out if the works in question are no longer meeting the mission of the institution by being either the best of what they might represent, or if they're duplicative, or if mm-hmm. they're in poor condition, or...
Or if you change your mission, as in Buffalo, or...
Yeah, not sure about that one, in the sense that one really has to be careful about changing a mission in a way that does that undoes what a generation and others before have put in place, especially if it's in some ways indexed to the vicissitudes of the contemporary art market. Mm-hmm. And I think, frankly, one of the joys of being back in an encyclopedic museum after the Whitney is to see works of the 20th and 21st century in a larger context and not to see them as isolate expressions. And so many younger artists benefit from working and being in the mm-hmm. presence of great mm-hmm. old masters. So that's a particular case that I wouldn't look at as a model. Mm-hmm. I think instead we should create the circumstances a very open dialogue about why we would be motivated to have something leave the collection. And I'm not saying collections should be static, and we obviously do deaccession, but we try to do it in light not of trading up within a particular artist, which is a reflex a lot of institutions have gone to, mm-hmm. but mm-hmm. simply duplicative, damaged, second quality, you know, second tier in quality, or mission has abandoned ship.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because We all see the choices made in the last generation of deaccession works that turn out to have been perhaps something worth hanging on to. And we all know the changes of taste about Bouguereau, you know, 30 years ago was an artist no one had any time for. Mm. And then by the late 1980s, he was, you know, extraordinary force in the art world. And that's been true. Think of the Pre-Raphaelites and how they fell out of fashion for many years and then came back. And so one has
I still consider them out of fashion.
No. Well, they're out of fashion, but they also obviously...
I think I just consider them outside of my taste.
Well, and all the more reason why we should be careful, because your taste, my taste, yeah, the taste no, of our exactly. curators, it's a malleable proposition.
Yeah.
And it may change with the next incumbent.
No, absolutely. Speaking of incumbents... No, I'm just kidding. the other thing I wanted to ask you about, I'm going to get that out of you, is you know, I mean, I could talk for a while about the web, and you know, you've said a little bit about it, but one thing that's also unusual about the dashboard is that it, and the dashboard is, I should sort of describe it, is essentially a place on the website, it looks like, where you can find all sorts of, it's sort of a Harper's Index of all sorts of numbers and measurements of things, and I wrote down some of them before coming in here. Daily attendance. In fact, there are two people who have come to the museum so far today, meaning tomorrow. So it's, what, almost 1 in the morning? We're doing this quite late at night. So two people have come into the museum.
Yeah, those are security
officers. Yes.
And we discount the numbers every week. We back out the number of staff and volunteers based on their traffic patterns.
But it was a strange thing to go to the website, mm-hmm. you know, maybe an hour ago to check See how many I saw people. And the museum's number of fans on Facebook. Mm-hmm. Levels of flooding in the park.
Yeah.
Or possible flooding.
Yeah, because we have 152 acres of grounds and they abut the White River, which is a tributary that can get pretty dicey. So because we have 10 artists working in our mm-hmm. Art and Nature Park, mm-hmm. it's good for them to know also mm-hmm. when the alluviation will begin.
What else? The museum's energy consumption, mm-hmm. finances, new members this year. But since you brought up, and also on the web, I should say, our videos from you on YouTube, I just found one from a few days ago, sort of talking about a new myelin installation, and the blog is really active. I also looked into the guidelines for bloggers at the museum, because I was wondering whether, you know, sometimes it strikes me that it feels tricky as a reader. Like, is the staffer speaking on behalf of the institution, or is the staffer speaking on behalf of the staffer, and how much sort of harnessing is going on there?
There ain't no harnessing, Jen.
Yeah, it looked fairly, it was really interesting, because actually it looked like the guidelines that are handed out to new bloggers are actually available for blogger readers, for yeah. blog readers to see, so they have a sense right. of the editorial guidelines, right. which was helpful for me. But since you brought it up, let's talk about the Art and Nature Park. Mm-hmm. 100 acres, right?
100 acres, yeah.
Quite something. Woodlands and wetlands.
And a 35-acre right? lake.
And there are, I will say, the IMA also has an extensive Flickr stream or mm-hmm. something. I don't know what mm-hmm. the noun is for that. Mm-hmm. And there are photographs of that land on there, a bunch of them. What I have understood your take on the Art and Nature Park is, I think you said this is, you know, essentially not about trophy hunting or monument building. I think those are your words. Mm-hmm. And that at this point it looks like projects will be limited in time 2 to 5 years or so? And it's scheduled to open in 2009, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
Okay. So is that still your thinking about the mm-hmm. park and why?
Well, among other things, unlike Much Haddam or Henry Moore's wonderful bronzes sit astride the landscape, or here at the beautiful Olympic Sculpture Park, we're not looking to tailor and harness nature and put art in that space. We've made a conscious decision to acknowledge that the 100 acres is actually a recovered industrial site where gravel was excavated to create a highway nearby. And there was wretched refuse of mm-hmm. industrial construction, and then nature took over. It overgrew all of that. It yeah. found its way into flooding what had been a gravel pit as a lake. We've really found that it's what you would expect, that Mother Nature is a very powerful force. Mm-hmm. And we decided, rather than trying to cut it back, we have ample meadows, which are obviously tailor-made for certain kinds of work. But we also have woodlands and wetlands, and the spaces in the wetlands will flood when that White River indicator says, here it comes. So it's inevitable that works are going to be subject to the elements. And as long as we're upfront with the artists that we bring in and give them an understanding that they can work with organic materials that may have a short lifespan, I think it's much more exciting to say, you can never see this park and have finished seeing it. It will always be changing because the scale of it is too vast to do otherwise. And it's enormous in both scope and ambition, but also we've got an $11 million endowment that's simply for commissioning art. So what we want to do is have iterative experiences that have a lifespan, and then either they disintegrate or they're destroyed or the artist deinstalls them, or they do persist. Mm-hmm. And we're going to leave that up to the individual artist to figure out what kind of materials they want to use. Mm-hmm. And we'll have that conversation with them as they go, mm-hmm. as we've had with Andrea Zatel and other artists who are thinking about what kind of mark they'd like to leave in the landscape.
Mm-hmm. There was an artist, Sam Easterson. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about what he did?
Well, Sam is a fascinating person because he started out looking at how recording the world through the eyes of animals would allow us to see the world in a very different light, i.e. not of someone who might be subject to a predator, mm. and not the eyes of a predator like ourselves. And I first got to see his work actually at the ICP in New York. He was part of a group show, and he had attached some cameras to plants, and so we were able to see the wafting of the breeze and watch this very fragile way of taking in the world. But Sam has done a lot of work with also this world of science, and he feels sometimes compromised because everybody wants him to do nature films, and he's really looking for some way of tapping into the expressive potential of what it means to be a creature in nature. Mm-hmm. So we had a project in which he basically found a mole. We have quite a few moles on the property, and attached basically a helmet painlessly. PETA, he's worked with PETA, so he's a guy who understands animal rights. And he attached...
Did the helmet have a chin strap?
Well, in effect, yeah. And the mole went down into his, burrowed into his tunnel with this miner's helmet that had a light on it. So we were actually able to see what the mole could not see as he went down into the tunnel. And we gave out baby monitors to visitors to the grounds, and they could actually watch the mole's progression and movement. For Sam, this was a really interesting experiment of having the visitor become empathetic in real time with the experience, not just a film loop of an animal who had been recorded, but actually have that. And he found it particularly enticing because it was a large park, and unlike most of the places he works where it's just a video loop in a gallery. So it was the first iteration of figuring out how this park might have a life beyond a standard art museum park.
The Olympic Sculpture Park in Seattle has similarities to the park you're talking about, although it's extremely different. It's extremely small, and obviously downtown. But at the Olympic Sculpture Park, admission is free. Will that be the case at the Nature
Everything, Park? Everything's free. Yeah.
The museum is now free again.
Yeah.
How important is free admission? What is your take on this? You know, for instance, Seattle Art Museum, just to give one example, we have three sort of main art museums in Seattle. The Fry is always free, and if you know about the history of the Fry, it's something of an anomaly. The Henry, it costs, but it doesn't cost if you're a student, and it's on the university campus, so it has a sort of you know, that university kind of. And then Seattle Art Museum has a kind of interesting policy where it's fairly nuanced, and therefore not many people actually know what the correct sort of rule really is, but it's that it's a suggested donation, except for shows like Roman Art from the Louvre, which you absolutely must pay $20 to get into if you're, you know, a general admission ticket holder. So, you know, there's some kind of room in there, but still, you know, recently I took a group of students to Seattle Art Museum, and it would have been nice to be able to show them the Roman Art Show, but it wasn't possible. So how important is free admission? But in addition to that, how possible is the sort of idea of universal museum admission?
Well, I've written a little bit about this because I've studied the statistics, and I took the largest 140 museums in the Association of Art Museum Directors, which is from the Metropolitan Museum on down, and added up our operating budgets. You get to $2.1 billion. Then I added up, this is 2007 data, then I added up all of the admission income from tickets, $116 million. So 96% of our revenue is not from tickets. So if my goal were to say, gosh, I could get us from 3.5% to 4% if I really charge more, it's not going to make any difference to my institution, and generally speaking it won't. But bear in mind there are different markets, there are different institutions within those markets, there are different expectations. Broadly speaking, in the Midwest, we don't charge admission at St. Louis and Minneapolis and the IMA. But the Art Institute started charging, I guess, last year. They enforced a $12 charge, which was a change. and, you know, Cleveland and so many other places just don't charge. Whereas on the coasts, that is a tradition in charging. Many institutions, mm-hmm. absolutely. Mm-hmm. And in part it has to do with tourist markets. The Midwest doesn't have, apart from Chicago, a tourist market. So there's a disincentive for people who live in a region to be asked to pay, whereas a tourist expects to pay. Mm-hmm. But I guess I approach it looking at two issues. One, I'm not out to make money off of the individual patron. I'm out to have affluent people write big checks, mm-hmm. because that's how museums are supported, 96% of it. Mm-hmm. And I'd like to grow that to 97% instead of having a person have to part with $12 or more. We charge $12 for special exhibitions, but 120,000 square feet of galleries are free, mm-hmm. and it's only the 10,000 square foot exhibition gallery that we charge for.
So similar to SAM, but without the suggested donation.
Right, yeah. And we also, I mean, we have a limit of $12 because we just feel that's enough of a lift for anybody, and it's discounted for kids and for seniors and so on. And in the end, I look at it this way. We got up to 465,000 visitors last year. Our city size is 765,000 people. Our metro area is 1.6 million. That's a pretty good ratio, I would say, in a place that isn't predominantly about tourism. And I'd rather have all those people come, and if they choose to spend in the store or buy a ticket to a film or participate in some other way electively, great. And if not, just come. Just drop in. I don't want it to be an occasion to go to the art museum. Mm. I want it to be a regular thing. I want people to come on Thursday and Friday nights just to come, without a sense of occasion.
Mm-hmm. You, I read somewhere, are either about to work on a kind of joint workshop in Minneapolis or have already?
Just did it a couple of weeks ago.
Okay, yeah. So that is, it sounded like working with the boards of directors at the Weissman, the University Museum, and then the Walker, obviously this contemporary art museum, and then Minneapolis Institute of Art, this sort of arts encyclopedic museum. Right. You know, Seattle also, like I said, has three museums. It's a slightly different model, but do you have thoughts on how museums can work together inside cities? Or are these just kind of generalized things that have always been true? Are there new ideas about how museums can work together?
Well, you know, Minneapolis is a socialist paradise. So it's separate and apart from any other city in any other state in the country. And it's blessed by an amazing progressive perspective about the importance of culture in daily life. Mm-hmm. And most other cities, our own included, just don't have that perspective from the start. Secondly, the three museums don't actually overlap precisely. I mean, one could say that the Weissman and the Walker have things in common, but they're not competing in that sense.
True.
And when the idea came of my speaking to the three boards of trustees at once, it was in part stimulated by the fact that there are two new female directors, mm-hmm. in a city which now has three female directors who get along very well and appreciate each other's professionalism and reputation. And I've worked with all three of them over the years, and it was an opportunity, they felt, to have a fresh conversation about how their respective boards could think about measuring success. And perhaps there were ways, given that they're all in different stages of campaigns and so on, that they could look collectively as a city about what matters, mm-hmm. in an institution. And the point I made to them, among others, is, from the attendance perspective, they've got nothing to worry about. They're a market similar to Seattle, Tacoma, similar to San Diego County. Mm-hmm. Basically, the three would be in a rough equivalency in size. And they attend museums in enormous numbers in Minneapolis. So let's not worry about building attendance, which is the natural reflex of a board normally. Let's think about the quality of the visitor's experience, the caliber of a collection, the importance of front-loading educational experiences in a museum. Let's talk about that. And it was a very receptive audience, and it was very gratifying. Mm.
Speaking of new female museum directors, have you run across Sylvia Wolfe, the new director?
She came tonight to the reception before the talk. Yeah, mm-hmm. It's great to see her.
Had you met her before?
Sylvia?
Yeah.
I hired Sylvia away from the Art Institute of Chicago to
be photography director.
That's right.
Now I remember.
Yeah.
I remember we spoke about this before. And tell me, if you would, I mean, what we're getting in a director? Because you've known her as a curator. Do you have a sense of, you know, what she's about as a director?
Well, she's an extremely warm and capable and extremely good connoisseur and a great organizer and manager. But I think she also has the long view about museums. She understands where museums have to go down the road, which is exactly not in this direction of artificial measurement about attendance and ticket sales, but actually by virtue of her long experience as a photography curator, she is in step with a lot of concerns of artists today who work in various media, but she's equally steeped in the history of photography and the history of modern culture back to the 19th century and before. And I think people will be really delighted by how inclusive and welcoming and warm she is as a person, in addition to being extraordinarily refined as a scholar and curator who will now bring all those attributes together as a very talented director. So I'm very excited to see her take flight here. And tonight, another former curator of mine at the Whitney has accepted the directorship of the Berkeley Art Museum. Mm-hmm. It was just announced tonight. Larry Rinder.
Oh, he has.
And so I'm really happy to see these two colleagues taking on leadership in the museum field. Both of them are remarkable people and will bring great things to their respective cities.
That is exciting. The last thing I want to ask you about is about the Midwest, is about being in a position that is perceived to be off the grid, in a kind of, you know, what would seem to be a sort of relieving way. There's a lot of conversation now sort of about the centers of the art world not being as central as they once were, and a sort of a new sense of openness and appreciation for kind of alternative areas. Seattle's occasionally the kind of benefactor of some of this, you know, sort of occasional goodwill or sort of, you know, ideas about that. And I wanted to ask, you know, how is it being there? How is it being in Indianapolis? How is it being in sort of the middle of the country in a certain sense? And, you know, in a place that has a just different relationship between the museum and maybe the city, maybe the visitors, maybe the artists, I don't know.
Well, I ran a museum in Toronto, the Art Gallery of Ontario, for a few years, and it was, I mean, Toronto is such a wonderful, vibrant, international city, and it loved its art museum, but in the way that Canadians love anything, there was always a degree of reserve around that love and cocked eyebrow. And worked in Atlanta for 8 years in an art museum, which was in a city better known for bars and baseball than for culture. So I had very different experiences from New York and how people approached their city museum. And in Indy, I think there's a great pride about the institution, but also a kind of caution about expecting too much of it. Mm-hmm. And that was fun for me, because I'm not, being not from Indiana, I really don't get that. I'm really excited about what we can do there. And I suppose the two things that attracted me most were a really staggering permanent collection that starts in depth with Chinese work from antiquity all the way through to remarkable holdings in ceramics for the most part. The Edo period Japanese pictures are the equal of any museum in the country. The African collection would match up with the white collection here, so among the five or six best. The textile collection, fashion arts, is 6,000 works, very strong. And most notably, the 19th century collection, the post-impressionist collection of Gauguin, the school of Pont-Aven, and the neo-impressionists, Seurat, Signac, and Luce, no equal in the U.S. So, to have the privilege of working with that quality of material and then to have an endowment that's nearly $400 million, which relative to a $33 million operating budget means we have room. We actually would be, along with the Kimball and the Getty, perhaps one of the three or four best endowed museums in the country in relation to our operating budget. Mm-hmm. And so I was very excited about the prospect of taking that and leveraging that to do things that are in some ways unexpected. We're doing a show of Spanish Baroque paintings, mostly borrowed from Spain, but also the influence of the liturgy on Hispanic painting broadly in Peru and Mexico in the course of the 17th century. And it's the kind of exhibition that has absolutely no connection to a market imperative, a public demand, a popular appeal. It's Catholicism in its most in-your-face character, with all of the trappings that we associate with processional objects. And we're going to show it in a Protestant American city and let the games commence. It will be as controversial as any Mauricio Catalan or anything else you could imagine. And not having the pressure of having to decide, can we really afford to do that show? I was very disillusioned recently. We were pitching one of the many shows we're organizing now to a peer institution, and their response was, we don't think it will draw enough, so we can't do it. And I don't have to think that way because of the generosity of people who built the museum over the years and the growth in its contributed income to the point where it has enough bench strength to take risks. And that's what a big endowment should be about. It shouldn't be about preserving wealth or preserving tradition. Opposite to that, it should be about encouraging risk and programming. And we're doing the largest show of European design since 1985 ever organized. We didn't start by asking the question, who's going to come, or can we sell enough tickets? We started with the question, can we build a collection by doing this show? And the answer is yes. So we'll acquire over 200 works of contemporary European design and launch a collection that way. So Indianapolis, I also look at through the lens of an Easterner who has a degree of, I would say, suspended disbelief about the South, and this, having lived in the South for 8 years, and the Southwest, and the Sun Belt in general, and watching how Las Vegas is running out of water is a terrifying thing to see from far away. If you look at old America, the Northeast and the Rust Belt, India is the fifth largest city in the United States outside of the Sun Belt in terms of city population. So I don't look at it as off the grid. I look at it as part of the core of the United States, which has remarkable traditions locally. But just by virtue of the fact that we now have a museum building that's almost 700,000 square feet with all this amplitude of offerings and three theaters, lots of things we can do, and we're going to start attracting people there because of the Art and Nature Park in particular. And with a new billion-dollar airport and all the trimmings that come with that, there'll be reasons to come. But I don't really start with the proposition, is something central or peripheral? I just try to make it central. Mm-hmm.
Thank you for taking the time.
Sure.
I'll let you get some rest.
Great pleasure to be with you, Jen. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. You've been listening to Invisible, the Stranger's Weekly Conversation with Art in Art.